Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, November 21st, 2013, during a live teleform conference call. Welcome to the Practice Group teleform conference call. On today's call, we'll be discussing patent reform. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion on today's call are those of the experts. Also, we're recording today's call for use as a podcast in the future. Finally, this call is open to press, so please be aware of that. We're happy to welcome to today's call three experts on patent law. We will hear from them in order. First up, Professor Thomas F. Cotter. He's the Briggs & Morgan Professor of Law at the University of Minnesota Law School. He will be followed in his opening remarks by Mr. James R. Copeland, Director, Center of Legal Policy at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research. And then third, we will hear from Professor Richard A. Epstein. He is the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at the New York University School of Law. They're each going to make opening remarks of about 5 to 7 minutes. Then we'll probably have a little discussion between and among them. And then finally, we will be turning to our audience for questions, so please be ready with your questions. And with that, Professor Cotter, the floor is yours for the next 7 minutes. Thank you.
All right. So I'll begin just by laying out what some of the current bills are, and then if I have some more time, I'll mention some other things as well. But all of these patent re-reform measures that are pending before Congress right now are intended in large part to address the phenomenon of patent trolling. There are some other provisions of some of these bills that deal with more technical measures, clarifying or correcting certain aspects of the America Invents Act. But by and large, they are all intended to address various problems that people have perceived as having arisen in connection with patent trolling. So just to mention what some of the more important ones, yesterday the Goodlatte bill passed the Senate, the House Judiciary Committee. This is the one that's known as the Innovation Act. And probably it's the most comprehensive of them, so maybe I'll start with that one, just lay out what some of the important features are. One feature of this bill that's shared by many of the others is the are these rules on transparency. So one of the critiques that has been raised about patent trolls is that it's often very difficult to know who actually is the ultimate parent company of a particular patent. We're talking about patents that were assigned, and then often there's a chain of various shell corporations. And so some people perceive this as being problematic. You often don't know which other patents might be potentially lurking out there and might be asserted by a related entity. So the Goodlatte bill and some of the others would require the disclosure of this information when a complaint is filed. The Goodlatte bill also would require the patent assignments to be regularly recorded with the patent office, which is something that we don't have right now. Another provision of the Goodlatte bill, a couple of provisions that are not found in some of the others, are these provisions on litigation management. And so the Goodlatte bill in particular would impose a heightened pleading requirement on patent infringement complaints. It would require district judges to stay discovery pending claim construction in order to keep costs down, and it asks the federal judicial conference to consider other types of reforms and case management policies. So this is a provision that's met with some pushback from some members of the federal judiciary who think that it's delving into the realm of micromanaging how they manage their dockets. Another provision of the Goodlatte bill, we find this one also in one or the of the other bills that's pending in the Senate, deals with attorney's fees. So, you know, the general rule in this country is that each side has to pay its own attorney's fees, and patent law, Section 285 of the Patent Act says that courts may award attorney's fees only in exceptional cases. The Federal Circuit has interpreted that provision quite narrowly, and so attorney's fees are only rarely awarded, really only when the assertion of patent infringement is objectively baseless and subjectively baseless, in a very, very small percentage of cases. So the Goodlatte bill would align the standard for awarding attorney's fees in patent cases to the standard that is employed in the Equal Access to Justice Act. Basically, there would be a presumption that the prevailing party would get its attorney's fees. The losing party can rebut that presumption by showing that the position that it took in litigation was substantially justified. So at the end of the day, I would say that most of the time, each side would continue to bear its own attorney's fees, but we would see at least some larger number of cases in which the prevailing party, in this case the prevailing defendant probably, would be entitled to recover its fees. There's also a provision dealing with customer suits, and so this is something that has really emerged as a potential problem in the last year or so. Patent law allows the patent owner to sue not only the infringing manufacturer, but anyone in the chain of distribution all the way down to the end user. Historically, that hasn't happened a great deal. Most of the time, patent infringement cases are involve the manufacturer as the defendant. But in some of these recent cases, for example, the litigation that's been brought by Innovatio IP Ventures, the strategy has been to send out cease and demand letters to people lower in the supply chain, to customers, coffee shops, hotels, places like that. And so many people perceive that as an abuse, and so the Goodlatte bill would provide for a stay of litigation against the customers if the manufacturer and the customer agree to the stay in writing, and some other conditions would have to be satisfied. So I would say those are the major provisions of that particular bill. The Leahy bill in the Senate is similar in some ways. It has the provisions on transparency, has a customer stay provision. One unique feature of that bill would authorize the Federal Trade Commission to go after bad faith assertions of patent infringement as unfair or deceptive practices under Section 5 of the FTC Act. This is a strategy that's somewhat analogous to what we've seen at the state level over the past year in Vermont, here in Minnesota, in Nebraska as well. Probably this would apply only in the most egregious cases. Most likely the sending of a demand letter would have some degree of First Amendment protection and or Norr-Pennington immunity, and so we would only be talking about cases in which the assertion of patent rights is objectively baseless and subjectively in bad faith. But in any event, the Leahy bill has that provision authorizing the FTC to act in that particular space. The Schumer bill has a provision that was in the Goodlatte bill until recently. It was taken out just the other day in the version that passed. But this particular bill would extend a provision of the America Invents Act that allows for review, post-grant review of certain business method patents when those patents are being asserted in litigation. It would extend this provision to include not only business method patents relating to the financial services sector, but all business method patents. So basically, if I sue you for infringing my business method patent, you, the defendant, could then ask the USPTO to re-examine the patent and possibly have it invalidated in that forum. One other bill, just to note, this was just introduced the other day by Representatives Paulus, Marino, and Deutsch, would impose certain requirements on the demand letters themselves. And it goes into fairly extensive detail about a cease and desist letter that's sent by a patent owner, what sort of information it would have to include, and if it didn't include that information, what the consequences. So that pretty much lays out the scope of the leading bills that are pending right now. As I mentioned, the Goodlatte bill is the one that has progressed the farthest so far, having passed the the House Judiciary Committee yesterday. So maybe I'll stop there and talk about my own views later in the hour, but I'll pass it now to Jim Copeland.
Thanks so much, Tom. This is Jim Copeland from the Manhattan Institute. And we did a recent report on the patent litigation as part of our Trial Lawyers Inc. system on so-called patent trolls. And let me explain sort of what I mean when we say patent trolls and what people generally mean. And I want to emphasize that my concern is not with these entities per se, and I think a positive step in the various bills that have been introduced recently is the way they backed away from sort of disaggregating different procedural rules for different types of patent owners. Because I think as a first principle, it's important to understand that you may very well want to be able to be an inventor, but not be an innovator or an entrepreneur that brings an invention to market. So you need to be able to have a market to sell your patent, and I don't implicitly think there's anything wrong with having a specialized entity to enforce patent infringement. The problem lies, as it does in most areas of litigation abuse in the United States, with the procedural rules that enable clever attorneys to game the system to extract duties from or extract rents from unwilling defendants who haven't done anything wrong. And the fundamental way this happens here, as it does in most forms of civil litigation, is the fact that the United States, as Tom mentioned, unlike most everywhere else in the developed world, doesn't have a fee-shifting mechanism wherein the loser of a lawsuit reimburses the winner. And therefore, the costs are misaligned such that if you're a defendant in any sort of civil lawsuit generally, it costs you more money to defend the suit than to settle a suit in many cases. So if you're not a large business who's a repeat player seeing a repeat game site type scenario with multiple types of litigation, you have an incentive to settle the case. And so with the patent attorneys that work here, and these are largely some of these are big company attorneys that have set up rather sophisticated shops, and then some of these, and these are the ones that I focused on in my report, the particularly bad actors here, they're sort of Texas lawyers, and due to other tort reform measures, the landscape for mischievous plaintiff attorneys in Texas as a matter of state law has dried up somewhat, but they've found that they can use the Eastern District of Texas, which has emerged as a jurisdiction of choice, to file these sorts of abusive litigation that Tom was talking about, where they'll buy an old patent that hasn't been used. The patent may or may not apply to some other technology, be it a Wi-Fi service or a scanner button on a printer. But rather than suing Hewlett-Packard or Xerox for the printer or what have you, these folks form shell entities. They have a the scanner button one, they formed something called MPHJ Technologies, and they mailed demand letters from 40 different affiliated shell companies with sort of nonsense names to hundreds of small, medium-sized businesses in the United States that were end users of printers and scanners, and virtually any business today is, and they sought $1,000 per worker in licensing royalties. Clearly, these small end users are going to face an incentive to settle at $1,000 per worker rather than litigating a patent claim to completion. And so this type of suit, and it's sort of a classic shakedown suit, it's not dissimilar in nature from the sort of shakedown suits we see in other types of civil litigation, is what's really sort of prompted the public outcry here for this sort of patent abuse. We have seen a significant growth in the volume of this litigation. So from 2006 to 2012, we saw a 526% increase in patent lawsuits filed by these patent assertion entities, the so-called patent trolls, and we saw basically a quadrupling of defenses that had to be raised against these patent lawsuits over roughly the same period. So we've seen a good number, a veritable explosion of sense, in a sense, of the number of these sorts of cases. Now, not all of these cases are of the abusive type I mentioned, and I think it's important when considering these pieces of legislation Tom was talking about that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I do think on net, as a whole, the legislation here tends to be a step in the right direction, because unlike some of the earlier versions of legislation reforming here, they're not trying to single out and say, well, these patent assertion entities are going to get a different set of rules from everyone else. Oh, but we want to make sure we don't talk about the universities because no one wants to tick them off, and trying to divide among different classes of plaintiff here in a way that I think is unhelpful and unuseful, because we don't want to sort of cherry pick how to enforce patent rights in this country. I do think, though, that fee shifting in particular is getting at the root of the problem. Now, unlike what we suggested in our Manhattan Institute report on this issue, the good luck bill and all of these bills are, to the extent they have fee shifting, it's a discretionary fee shift on the part of the judge. The risk with such discretionary fee shifts is always that the judge is inevitably going to say, well, we're going to only shift the fees against the defendants but not against the plaintiffs, and turn it into a de facto one-way fee shift, which is going to encourage more of this type of litigation. I have a little bit less concern about that here than I would in the general case. It sets up the default rule as the fee shifting. So the motion to get around the fee shift has to be made. The judge has to consider it. And what that means here, I think, is twofold. A, just in terms of the incentives of your everyday judge, it's going to require more work for them to grant that motion than it will be to deny it. In other words, there's just sort of an inertia incentive of judges where they don't want to spend a lot of time on these fee issues. Secondly, they're going to have to articulate a rationale in writing to overturn it, to say we're not going to shift the fees if the default runs the other way. And that's going to be reviewable by the Federal Circuit. And I think the Federal Circuit has a pretty good level of expertise in dealing with this. So it's not as if the Eastern District of Texas is going to be throwing these cases into circuit courts that don't see them every day. And so I think there's a chance that it could work relatively well, although it's not ideal, and it's not necessarily the sort of broader reform that I would want in this area. But I think it's sort of a tentative step that makes some sense. So I'll turn it over to Richard Epstein now, and we can discuss further later.
Well, I'm not sure that I'm utterly without words, but when we had our preliminary discussion, we were trying to figure out what the scope of the disagreement amongst us would be. And having heard the first two speeches, I think that the differences amongst us are going to be relatively narrow. So let me at least start with one part of the argument and get into the other. One of the things that has happened is the question is, what's your general attitude towards the patent system and how you think it works? There are many people who would like to deconstruct it from top to bottom, with such proposals as, for example, unless you manufacture something, you're not allowed to license it. And, of course, that seems to me to be crazy, because what it does is it makes it impossible to have a division of labor, and it means that entry into two new markets with ideas requires that you develop a heavy plant. What sort of plant? Who knows? It's also the case that if you're going to have a licensing arm, you have to have a litigation arm, because nobody will pay you money in the voluntary market unless there's a threat that they can be sued in the involuntary market to the extent that they try to practice the invention without their approval. So the fact that there is specialization with respect to collection, in addition to specialization with respect to licensing, is fine, and I don't care whether they're in one corporation, two corporations, or three corporations. The analogy that I sometimes give is that debt collection is an important part, but an unpleasant part of the business, and many people assign their claims out to third parties and let them bring the action. But that's the first point. The second point, then, is what about abusive litigation? And as one constantly wants to stress in this particular field, is that litigation is a form of aggression. What makes the thing a little bit difficult is that when you have a valid claim, a defense is a form of aggression on the other side. So that in thinking about these questions, you always have to worry about the two kinds of error and how it is that you're supposed to manage both of them simultaneously. So in this particular case, I think the first piece about the Goodlatte bill, which I don't like, is just the atmospherics, making what I think to be rather extravagant claims about, you know, the total amount of damages and monies that are wasted in these kinds of economies and so forth, because that kind of creates an atmosphere which says that the large patent system, which serves very well in the complex licensing arrangements that it does, between very large entities with very extensive portfolios is somehow or other suspect. And if you start with that view, then you're going to have other reforms that don't necessarily relate to these issues, like the rules on injunctions and damages, which will, I think, go in the wrong direction. That, in my view, is what has happened with the FTC report on this stuff, which I think is insufficiently patent protective. But in this particular case, the good news is that the word troll does not appear in the legislation, even if it appears in the rhetoric. And the basic proper response is we have a uniform set of rules with respect to how it is that you're able to litigate. And if it turns out that these patent assertion entities built for speed in certain cases are, in fact, the culprits, they will just run afoul of them more often than other companies. So there's nothing wrong with having a neutral set of rules, which is sensibly calibrated, where it turns out that some businesses and their models are hurt while other businesses and their models are not. So at this particular point, it seems to me that this is, in fact, a reasonably sensible way to start. Then the question is, what do we have to do? And I think, in effect, that large companies sending ominous letters to small businesses which are not in the business of defending patents, don't know much about the culture, is a recipe for social abuse and disaster. The question is how it is that one defends against this. One possibility is to simply do nothing through the public sector and to have a large company, say Cisco, write to all of its end users, you know, you get sued on one of these things, we're going to intervene and we're going to basically defend you. So now instead of having to face a little guy who's going to capitulate on £1,000 or $1,000, you now have to fight against some guy who has got a strong repeat interest and he's not going to pay this particular kind of money. To that, you then add the rules having to do with estoppel, and you say, look, you know, you guys are trying repeated tries at the apple. Let's litigate this first one in a big-time way, and if, in fact, you lose that one, you're going to be forever barred. So now the systematic advantage goes to the defendants because the non-present defendant, in effect, is entitled to litigate these things anew. The proposal in this statute, in some sense, is to stay the small litigation so that the big litigation could take place. I'm not sure whether that's a better or worse type of situation, but it's certainly something which is really quite respectable in terms of the way in which things go. Secondly, if I've always been an opponent of the general notice pleading rules under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, precisely because they don't give a defendant sufficient or deficient information to figure out how to organize that defense. Oddly enough, if you want to think about these rules in historical context, in this particular area, it's kind of a return to the code pleading requirements. What you have to do is to specify what the patent is that's been in breach, and you have to indicate the design feature of the apparatus that you're talking about, which in fact is in the violation of the system in question. I don't see anything whatsoever that is wrong with that unless it becomes so technical that valid claims get thrown out as a matter of course. So that seems to me essentially to be something that one really ought to consider under these circumstances. The third thing that has been mentioned is what we do with respect to covered business method patents and so forth. Generally speaking, I should say that I work for a company called Data Treasury, which in fact imposed the re-exam provision as it was supposed to go to certain business method patents. I thought that statute was a complete mess. This was a classic case of a company which won every litigation thrown against it, and to my view is after you've won the litigation in the federal court system, we do not want re-examinations, even if we may want it before litigation takes place. Indeed, I think this legislation may well be unconstitutional because what it does, in effect, is undermines judicial judgments in individual cases, and that's been widely construed to be a violation of the general norms on separation of powers, and it also might arguably be a taking if you think that the final judgment vests a property right in a plaintiff that happens to have won in a particular case. And I also agree with Jim, you don't want to fragment these rules on reexamination. So I have some sympathy, not a lot, but some respective sympathy for having re-exams before these things go out into the market, but none for undoing judgments. And also, I am worried about the fact that, you know, more than one person can play a strategic game, and reexamination, which delays the collection under a patent, is in fact a very dangerous thing to do when it turns out that you've got yourself a valid patent. So I would stay away from that. And then just briefly to finish this thing up, what about the fee-shifting arrangements? I think that Jim is surely right that we do not want to have this is a deeply discretionary system because the ad hocery of the lack of uniformity is going to be very grave. The English method, which is to put this thing down to a taxing master to figure out what's going on, may be a kind of a solution. The problem is, can you transfer it to American soil if everything else remains the same? My danger or my fear in some of these cases is they can become a one-way de facto system, so that it turns out that the good guy manages to get the fees and the bad guy does not. And remember, there is nothing wrong about asserting a valid patent. The whole point about this system is to figure out which way the error rate goes. And given what Jim said about East Texas, and given what we know about the vast increase in some of these customer suits that are being brought in last years, there's a change in circumstances that warrants this kind of protection, so long as we make it clear when we support it that we think that the basic rules of patent, in my view, as developed under the 1952 Act, are sound and ought to be kept in place. And with that, I think we probably should either have a little exchange or open it up.
All right, very good. Let's do a little of both, frankly. We'll open it up to questions and see how many, take the temperature of the audience, see how many questions we have. So in a moment, you'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, you can indicate so by pushing the star button and the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And while we're waiting to see who rings in, our lines are open. We don't have a question just yet. Let me mention that tomorrow at 1 p.m. we'll be discussing in another Teleform conference call the recently settled Mount Holly disparate impact case. That was a case headed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Asking a question about disparate impact, and it was settled. So we'll have a Teleform conference call discussing that settlement tomorrow at 1 p.m. Today we're speaking with Mr. Copeland and Professors Cotter and Epstein about patent reform. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And while we wait for people to ring in, let me just ask, and we can hear from all of you, the America Invents Act, of course, was, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 years in the making. It was adopted 2 years ago. I heard Professor Epstein talk about sort of a change in circumstance and some comments from others. But it's why revisit this so soon, and why move so quickly? That's one question I've heard sort of in the hinterlands. So I'll ask that of any of the experts.
Well, the simple answer is, if you post 211 verdicts or practices with respect to selective suits on customers was not addressed in that statute, because it hadn't happened. I think it's a mistake to revisit the business method patent issue, because that was something that was up for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that, you know, with that one exception, the none of the pending bills really make any serious or substantial changes to the AIA. They really address matters that weren't at issue when the AIA was enacted. And I think the patent trolling phenomenon has become a much more widely understood phenomenon just in the last 2 years, and Congress is responding to
not only understood,
Professor Cotter,
it's changed, right? They didn't do this 2 years. They didn't do this 2 years ago, suing end users.
Oh, suing the end users. That's a fairly new phenomenon. Yes,
it's relatively new. I mean, it's really over the last decade, but it's accelerated significantly in recent years. And the basic answer, I think, this is Jim to Dean's question, is simply, I just don't think this is what the AIA was addressing. And whether the AIA was a good or a bad reform is sort of a separate question from this, but I just don't think this is really what they were focusing on when they were writing that piece of legislation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let me ask if anybody, any of our experts, wants to respond to something they might have heard from one of the other experts, expound on their own comments. We do have a couple questions pending, but let's take a minute to see if Jim or Tom has something they want to respond to Richard and vice versa.
I mean, actually, I think we're probably more in agreement than I would have thought coming in. I think, you know, I agree that licensing is generally a good thing, you know, that it makes for an efficiently working patent system. And I think what we ought to be addressing, I think what these rules are trying to address, are abuses of the litigation system. And the only caveat I would have is that there are many features of patent law that make this abuse of litigation possible. These bills address some of them, and they may, you know, have some success in turning things back a little bit, but you know, there are a lot of other problems with patent law. Maybe they can be addressed, maybe they can't be addressed, but we shouldn't expect any of these bills to perform miracles and make the patent trolling problem go away entirely.
You know, I mean, you know, somebody actually brought a RICO suit, if you remember.
Yeah.
In connection with the Innovatio situation, which I think is something of a stretch. But you could see it was clearly an effort to sort of circumvent the basic big guy against little guy litigation by having some big guy take after another big guy and start to shop them. I mean, and you know, there is a recent case involving FRAND litigation under Inovatio, which is extremely difficult to get its way because not only do they sue little guys, they also sue people in connection with what they call standard-setting organizations and FRAND patents or the system-wide essential patents, which raises a completely different set of issues of how big players interact and organize standards amongst themselves. And I think it's a good thing about this bill that it took up only the one question and did not try to figure out what to do with this standard essential patent issue at the same time. But Inovatio is a player which seems to be leaving a very large footprint on the landscape.
All right, we've got two callers. Go ahead.
Go ahead. I just wanted to point to a couple things that these bills don't address that are part of the problem. And one is this sort of general forum shopping problem. Now, again, that's inherent in all litigation here, but it is curious when you've got the Federal Circuit as the review court here, but you don't have a specialized trial court here. So it is the Eastern District of Texas has about a quarter of all these patent cases nationally. And that's not because most patent activity or patent holders or what have you have some sort of locational nexus there. So it's probably a bigger fix than people are willing to think about or bite off right now. But I do think it's just an interesting thing to note. And the second thing is I don't believe any of these bills have dealt with the International Trade Commission rule here. And we've seen a significant growth since 2006 there too. So the percentage of patent troll cases and all the patent litigation at the ITC has grown from 6% in 2006 to a majority in 2011. And part of the reason is that the ITC is not subject to a 2006 Supreme Court decision, the eBay ruling, eBay v. Merck Exchange, which narrows the injunctive relief standard. But the ITC doesn't follow that rule. So I just think that's another interesting piece of not in these bills.
They got slapped down the last time by a political override. And, you know, one of the questions is what we think about eBay more generally. And one of the terms that got introduced in the last Inovatio dispute is one that I think has to be made more public, is they always talk about the holdup problem associated with having an injunction. But there is also a reverse holdup problem. If somebody says that the damages are sufficiently small that I'm better off violating this stuff and going my own way, at which point you could get an epidemic in the opposite direction. So I'm not at all sure that one wants to let anything that is going on in this particular area of abusive litigation influence the question in which you want to structure remedies amongst sort of professional licensing people in the cross area. That is, my view about it is that when you're dealing with people who are all producers who have cross licenses and some licenses, it's very different from the world in which you have end licenses filled with a bunch of amateurs who thought they were buying a product and not buying 1,000 lawsuits against them. And so I think it's good to keep these things separate. And my own view is I don't think the America Invents Act did much good with respect to the standard areas, because what they did is they took the 1952 Act and they gunked it up in a bunch of ways. And on some of the choices, like, for example, that between first to file and first to event, it turns out each rule has its Achilles heel. And so my general view is you don't want to switch on those things unless you can be clear that there's a substantial gain. And I don't think that burden was met in that particular case, for example.
And just to seize on one thing you mentioned, one of the problems with the patent trolling phenomenon is that the patent trolls are not making products that could be the subject of countersuits. And so when we have one big player versus another big player, there's a large probability that they'll reach some sort of cross-licensing agreement.
Yeah,
in this case, we don't have that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, look, to the extent that these trolls are basically the enforcement arms with respect to a substantial corporation, that prospect is still on the table. You just go back to our Qualcomm or our Viacom or whatever it is, and, you know, they'll sit and talk to you. It's when they're freestanding entities who pick up dreggy patents from nobody and there's no long-term stuff that you can't go back on the opposite side, which is why the threat of abuse is serious. You know, I was just teaching this in contracts the other day about whether or not when there's a threat of a lawsuit and somebody pays, you know, basically is taking less than the full amount of the debt, you've got a defendant's holdout. Is there any way that you can deal through that with doctrines of duress on consideration and so forth? And largely the answer to that question is only at the edges. You need to have very systematic procedural rules. So this is a legitimate problem that requires a legitimate response.
All right, let's turn now to the audience. We do have three callers with questions. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. With that, let's go to our first caller.
Hello?
Hi.
Right ahead.
Hi, it's Susan Braden. I'm a judge in the Court of Federal Claims. I am interested in the professor's view about the constitutionality of the Goodlatte bill.
I mean, of the constitutionality?
You made
which
a passing remark.
You mean on the question about the business method patent and the re-exam? Yeah,
no.
I think it's all on, if that's the part of a judge, I think that is unconstitutional. To me, the basic distinction that we have is that when it comes to adjudication, the courts are responsible. And if somebody says, we don't like this adjudication, we're going to let you open it up, and then in effect expose somebody who's prevailed to something else, that's a very serious situation. I also think in my own mind that the takings issue are kind of important there because the defendants have established a property right, at least with respect to a given claimant, and now in effect that this thing is opened up, it's again the same thing. Now, it turns out there are a bunch of decisions, which I haven't read recently, in the patent court, which attempt to try to get around the Plouffe distinctions, which sort of take the categorical line, and my own reaction from memory, but not from particular stuff, is I did not think that those were particularly well-reasoned cases. I think this is an area in which you don't want curlicues, and that the basic fundamental principle is that when a thing is res judicata, it doesn't matter whether it's a patent case or any other kind of litigation.
But wait, we're not talking about re-examining patents that have been found to be valid and infringed. I mean, isn't there? It's
no, no. The rule covers both. That's why, I mean, the reason, let me tell you how I got involved in this. I represented a client called Data Treasury, which won many of these lawsuits, and a lot of the stuff in Section 18 was designed to deal with their patents. There was a previous effort, the Check 21 Acts, which were designed to pass what I thought was a grotesque statute, which said that, you know, when it comes to certain business method patents having to do with banking operations, you can't win with respect to checks and get damages, injunctions, or attorney's fees. And then when that was beaten the first time, the banks came back with a second round, which says the only exceptions to that rule are patents that are made by banks. So outsiders are going to be limited and not. So there was a lot of this side history there. And, you know, there was a fairly complicated set of lawyers on both sides of this issue. You know, I wrote on one side. I can't remember if it was Chuck Cooper who wrote on it. Michael McConnell and Viet Dinh wrote on the other. It was like a Federalist Society meeting with respect to this issue on this whole question of separation of powers. But there is a particular history in this thing in addition to the general concerns.
Well, we've got two questions pending. If you want to ask a question, you can indicate so by pushing the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
When you were discussing the bills, this is Chase Ames, a law student at the University of Utah. When you were discussing bills that have been introduced in Congress currently, I didn't hear Senator Hatch's bill named. I was wondering if you could compare that one to the others.
Yeah, the Hatch bill.
Professor Cotter, let me interrupt you just briefly and ask if you could speak up. We're
having
a little bit of difficulty hearing you.
I'm sorry.
Go right ahead.
I am getting over a cold, but I'll try to speak up. The Hatch bill is a little bit more limited in scope, so it would basically it addresses the attorney's fees issue, and like the Goodlatte bill in the House, it would impose the Equal Access to Justice Act standard, the presumption that attorney's fees would be granted to the prevailing party unless the losing party's position was substantially justified. The only significant difference is that it would explicitly authorize the court to require the patent owner to post a bond to ensure that that the payment could be made, whereas the Goodlatte bill doesn't have that provision. It has a different way of trying to deal with the issue of what might happen if the patent owner is unable to pay the other side's attorney's fees. So anyway, the Hatch bill, I believe, is limited just to that specific issue and probably would be incorporated into something larger if it winds up making it all the way.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. Professor Epstein, were you going to say something?
No, I mean, what I was going to say is, you know, this is a subset of a larger problem, and it's perfectly in keeping with the general view that what we're talking about is the civil procedure side of patent law, and we're not trying to attack the substantive issues. It's only the business method stuff, which I think comes close to that, because you're trying to bring a new set of patents into a set of procedures. I think the parity, in fact, is required, but I'd rather them get rid of the whole re-exam here rather than extend it everywhere else. One of the things I'm worried about is that these re-examination provisions are open very strategically to defendants maneuvering one kind or another. We have not done well in the world of innovation. One of the things that seems to have happened, the more we worry about the patent system, the more complicated it gets. And I, for one, think that the 1952 Act was a masterpiece, and basically the 2011 Act is kind of overloaded from top to bottom.
I think I heard Jim Copeland mention that the current bills don't address all the problems quite. And now I've just heard Professor Epstein talk about, I don't know if you'd call it persistent tinkering or revision. Is there going to be additional patent legislation in the near future, even if this passes, Jim Copeland?
Yes.
And Professor Epstein?
Well, far be it for me to pontificate about what's likely to happen there, but I do think you get a policy window, and I think it's unlikely that you'd get anything in the near term. I think the answer to that, when it comes to this particular problem that we're talking about, is whether the legislation does anything to fix it. But even if it doesn't, it doesn't mean that, you know, it's not as if, you know, the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 95 and then securities litigation, it's imperfect too, and it's not as if Congress has ever gone back to that. It has made some positive difference in some areas. But so I think it would be good to try to get it right the first time, but I would certainly not want to, you know, a marginal bill that improves the status quo and doesn't create major problems of the sort Richard's talking about, I think would be something worth getting behind. So you're never going to get everything you want.
I'm going to mention two things. One is CAFA, the Class Action Fairness Act, was another bill of similar import. There was a battle there which might take place here about retroactivity with respect to suits previously filed. In this particular case, you know, I don't think there's a particular problem, even if a suit's been filed, but it hasn't been resolved, to say, look, at this particular point, you have to meet these requirements and give that additional information before you can go forward. And I would certainly be that. But the other point to understand about this one is it has a very different time frame from the AIA. The AIA will not do anything to change patents under the 52 Act, and those disputes will continue to come for many, many years. And it's going to be a while before most of the litigation is going to be on post-2011 patents. This thing, as best I can tell, would immediately, once the day it goes into effect, the next day that somebody brings one of these things, it's going to apply to what's happening. So I think in many ways the time frame on this is much foreshortened, and that may give it a much more dramatic effect,
if you
do it right.
And I was going to say, you know, I mentioned, you know, there are many features that give rise to patent trolling, and this bill only addresses some of them. You know, addressing some of the other ones may or may not be a good idea, because it may wind up changing too many other things that are unbalanced or are beneficial in our system. But you know, among other things, independent invention is not a defense to a charge of patent infringement, probably for good reason.
Yeah, I don't want to change that.
But the mere fact that rule exists means that there is an opportunity for patent trolls to sue people who are not deliberately copying anything, but simply happen to have independently invented the same thing.
Yeah, I think that's the kind of huge cosmic change that you don't want to introduce, particularly in a world in which we know that inventions tend to come in clusters. And if you then have to go through the intent side, I think you're just asking for trouble. One of the provisions of the 2011 Act I don't like are those people who said, you know, we were beginning on research on this thing before the patent came out and were allowed to continue in the same area. Private facts within their own control, being a substantive defense against an outsider, I think is an absolute invitation to disaster. And I prefer the old rule, which says, in effect, you know, we don't give any special research exemption of this particular sort for the second comer. And what happens is you discover that people don't sue folks who are using their inventions in order to develop properties or complementary products which will increase their sales. So that was, I think, fixing a problem that wasn't broken. And that's what I meant by this sort of endless tinkering. You find one case called Maddie, and all of a sudden you forget it's an idiosyncratic case, and you try to now reorganize the world around it. So I don't want to – I think we need some bed rest from that kind of reform, at least at the present.
I tend to agree with Richard on that. This is Jim Copeland again. I get much more nervous when we talk about tinkering with substantive rules of patent law than with procedural rules that apply to the patent situation and create these opportunities for sort of shakedowns.
Mm-hmm. All right. I want to give Professor Cotter and Jim Copeland both a chance to respond to what I think I heard Professor Epstein say, and Professor Epstein, feel free to correct me, but you were talking about the constitutionality, the unconstitutionality of certain aspects
yeah.
Of the bill, especially the reexamination question. And I hadn't heard from Jim Copeland or Professor Cotter on that. I want to give them a chance to respond there. Is Professor Epstein right? Or?
Well, I mean, if you're talking about reexamining of a patent in litigation that's already been declared valid in that same litigation, I think that is a problem. I don't know that that's going to be – I mean, Richard is mentioning a case, if there's a case that's in which that's happened, I'm not aware of that. But, I mean, normally I would
well, there are cases
say
that
the
happened
litigation.
Yeah, but which is it happens, and then the reexamination starts to take place before a final appeal is resolved. And, you know, I would apply this rule even after the basic trial judgment. And, in fact, one of the things I don't like about the AIA is it allows the patent court to basically stay the judicial litigation. And I think, in effect, that's also a very dubious form of interference. I'm not happy about the way the PTO was organized on that because there's much too much discretion in the way in which the head of the organization could decide which particular judges will be brought on to handle which particular case. And I think that kind of ad hocery is a very dangerous situation. There are many things about the current bill that I think are, in fact, give too much discretion in all the wrong places. And Jim Copeland is duty-bound to agree with me, Jim, because you started to talk about the discretion associated with awarding the fees. This is a similar kind of problem, only here you introduce a risk of systematic bias.
I'm not a constitutional law expert, and so I turn to Richard often on these sorts of questions. I mean, he's written books on tinkerings, right? So, but I think I understand some of the thought process here that's underlying it on a policy side, and that is, particularly as the computer software world was taking off, the Internet was taking off, the Patent Office granted patents that it probably shouldn't have.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, Schumer's sort of tackling a different issue there, and he's, you know, doing it for reasons that may or may not be good. I've got suspicions, but I understand some of the instinct here, but I also think Richard's very right. If you've got an adjudication out there, the last thing you want is to have a regulatory body somehow trumping a judicial process that's underway. I do think it could be useful to think about ways where a company that is very active in a field might try to come in there before adjudication's underway and clean up some of the patent space by reexamining some issues out there. And if they found it worth their while, and they may or may not, you know, something like the inverse of a patent trolls may develop on the other side. In other words, you might have specialized entities that go out there and try to find patents that be problems for companies and reexamine it ex ante before you get down that road.
You don't need that, Jim.
Yeah.
I don't think you need that. The patent disclosure process is public during the filing stage, and if it's talking about prior art, I think you could give it before the first determination is made. I'm not wrong on that, am I, Tom, about the procedures?
Wait, before the first determination, before the patent is granted, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, you're allowed to make comments, but under the AIA, now we have the post-grant oppositions that we'll have.
Yeah, I'm talking about the pre-grant situation.
Pre-grant, well, you can bring prior art to the attention of
the patent. And that's, to me, the key feature in these things. If you could do it prior, I don't see any case for doing it later.
Well, but there are so many patent apps. I mean, we're granting 250,000 of these a year.
To
be monitoring all of these and addressing
but I
them.
Think they,
you know,
they
during
do.
That very short window of opportunity probably is going to result in a lot of invalid patents otherwise not being detected.
It might be, but my view is that most valid patents are worthless, and the question is, what's the probability of a really valuable patent coming through with a sea change? not always impossible to do, but I think these companies already do monitor this stuff, because one of the reasons they have to monitor is to figure out where there's space for their own inventions. And they also have to monitor because the disclosures will start to tell them how to think about making either substitutes or complementary goods. My own preference would be I'd rather keep that window open another month than allow years to come by afterwards, because I think in most cases you won't take advantage of it. And if you do and you get the prior art early on, it nails the case in a way that gets rid of a lot of difficulties. I mean, I think the most important thing to do is to increase average patent quality going out of the PTO. And at that point, then the licensing system, it becomes more robust, and your willingness to give injunctions become much greater, and real damages. So if we could clean that thing up, and I think it may take some stuff is true, I will mention that away. And people have told me this, and I believe them. Yesterday I was on a panel with a man named John Potter, and he said there was a lot of bad stuff being issued to around 2005, 2006. But when first Dudas and then Dave Kappos, somebody with whom I work now, got in there, they actually managed to improve the average level of the patents across the board. And you don't want to create future processes to deal with a backlog, which ended 7 or 8 years ago. You'd rather assume that you could keep the changes that have been made with the last two PTO heads in place and not try to tailor your rules for the old ones that are out there.
No, that's true. But on the other hand, I mean, nobody really is suggesting having a full-blown pre-grant opposition. Some countries have tried that, and the danger.
No, I'm against that.
The danger there that you have a lot of gaming and trying to slow things down.
But that'd be terrible. All I'm saying is introduce prior art.
Well, but even that may not be effective enough is what I'm saying in response.
Well,
to that.
But I mean, I'm willing to get, as Jim said, a little bit of an improvement with a simple device is better than a lot of chaos with a more complicated procedure. So start there, figure out what it looks like, and then reassess.
Well, I mean, as it is now, we have these oppositions in place, and that's consistent with the law.
Yeah, so I'm not a real fan of the post-grant review stuff, actually.
All right, we've got a little less than 10 minutes left. We've got one question pending. If you want to join the ranks of the questioners, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hello, this is Mark Schultz. I am co-director of academic programs at the Center for Protection of Intellectual Property at George Mason. I have a couple of brief comments. I'll pretend are questions. First of all, is this really any way to run a property system? It took 50 years to reopen the 52 Patent Act and about a decade to finish the AIA. And here we are reopening things again. And wouldn't it be naive to think that we aren't sending a signal that the patent system is open for revision, perhaps on a yearly basis, and for political adjustment according to who can make the most noise? We have an effort here in a rush to judgment funded by a handful of tech companies funding several organizations pushing hard for this, and it's, I think, given their success, I think we can expect more attacks on software patents and other aspects of the patent system. Why would they stop? They've had a pretty free run so far. Second comment is based on this. I've heard some statistics thrown around, and a lot of this debate has been driven by an assertion that there's a patent litigation explosion. And the General Accounting Office report recently issued on this found that a lot of the studies that people cite repeatedly on cost and the litigation explosion were non-random and non-generalizable. And we have some better statistics out there showing that the ITC explosion is a myth. And a recent study released last week by Professors Christopher Catropria, Jake Hassan, and David Schwartz that concludes that data reveals a much lower percentage of litigation brought by patent-holding companies than other studies, and no explosion in NPE litigation between 2010 and 2012. And they put any change that's happened down to the change joinder rules of the AIA, which seems fairly obvious. So I'll stop there. I'll pretend it's a question and say, isn't it terrible?
I think they're very serious objections. On the first point, the only reason why I would worry about this sort of Tratton-Pohl stuff is that I don't think it was covered by the earlier act. And if you're right, it's not going to be a serious impediment on the way in which you're doing it. And you're surely right that there is no reason to basically create join the rules which now get multiplicity of litigation. And I think, Tom, if I'm not mistaken, there's one guy who actually wants to reverse that. But I also agree with you on the long-term situation. We do not want annual reviews on this. I do not think we needed the AIA. I thought the 1952 Act was, on balance, quite superior to this one. I always like to add, this was the statute was drafted by a committee of two and was passed unanimously by voice vote. That's not the politics we have today.
Well, I mean, I would object to some of the statements that the speaker made, with respect. But patents and other forms of intellectual property are property in one sense, but they're not property like real property or personal property in another sense, because they are non-rivalrous in consumption. And if we really want to take the property metaphor seriously, then, you know, why is it that patent assignments are not recorded, for example? I mean, that would be one of the changes brought about by the Goodlatte Act, which I think would be for the better. You know, if you have a real estate deed, you know what your property covers. If you have a patent, you often don't know what it covers, and then that's one of the problems that none of these bills address. And I'm not sure anybody can address it through legislation. I think it would be more a matter of judicial interpretation of claim definiteness. But it's the opacity and the uncertainty with regard to what a patent actually covers that enables a lot of this abusive behavior. And I think that is something that if Congress doesn't address it, and perhaps it shouldn't, at least the court should be addressing something.
No, I think the particularity arguments are clear. I think you're right about that. They did that with securities. And, you know, I think Jim Coltman's attitude is we want improvements. We never expect perfection. And you look at these things through that eye. So I think, in effect, if you treat this as the procedural tune-up of some of the things that were neglected, it's a much safer situation than starting to look at a reexamination of some of these bad rules.
Yeah.
I actually have an exception to Mark's rule, which is some of the repeal of the stuff in the 2011 Act and going back earlier to the 1952 Act, I think is fine because it returns to stable expectations. I think introducing a new third generation of changes on top of the second one would be a grievous mistake.
And I would like to just address the other thing, too, about, I mean, is patent trolling a real phenomenon or is it just a myth? And, you know, it is a real problem in my view. It's not make-believe. Now, you can look at the Katropia study, which doesn't say it's not a problem. They do document that the number of cases or the number of defendants has not gone up significantly over that two-year period. But I think if we go back over a decade, we certainly see an increase in patent litigation and in cases brought by patent trolls. The survey evidence that's been conducted, you know, about startups, you know, the lawsuits against coffee shops and places like that, none of this is make-believe. I mean, these are real problems. These are real abuses that need to be addressed.
Now, Mark, do you disagree with that, Mark? I'm just curious. Mark Schultz, the speaker.
Is my microphone still on?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
you're going to get the last word.
For one thing, there are ways to address these abuses. Attorney generals are talking about addressing them. There's a broad coalition of legal clinics at law schools that have been funded to address them. And the end-user lawsuits are actually historically not new. We had more end-user lawsuits in the 19th century than we do at the moment, back in the days of so-called patent sharks and suing farmers over digging wells. We worked through it in the system back then without fundamentally changing the system, and I think we can work through it again.
Yeah, I mean, this is Jim. I mean, I think where I disagree with Mark here is in viewing this as a fundamental change to the system. In other words, putting aside the cabining the issue Richard's talking about business methods patents or reexamination, these procedural fixes we're talking about, I don't think are fundamental changes. I think I think our fee shifting system or lack thereof in general is bad across all types of civil litigation, and so I do think that statistically we've seen an increase in this behavior. I also, though, do agree with Mark that the two-year significant bump in 11 and 12 is significantly a function of the AIA joinder rule, and in our report we acknowledge that. I mean, I think it skews the numbers somewhat. So the numbers I gave at the outset, you know, deflate them somewhat, but there's still an actual growth phenomenon here. But again, that's not necessarily bad inherently. A non-practicing PAE or NPE or whatever you want to call these patent troll groups, I don't think there's an inherent problem with that. And we might think that if it's a more efficient way to prosecute, to handle these claims, to litigate these claims, to enforce your patent, we might expect that sort of trend toward it. But what I do think is disturbing is this sort of shakedown suit type of phenomenon. And I think fee-shifting rules, a fairly simple procedural fix, can on the margin make a big difference there, just like it would in mass tort litigation and other areas where I've advocated it.
Okay.
All right. Well, this is Dean Reuter once again. I want to thank our experts today, Jim Copeland, Professor Thomas Carter, Professor Richard Epstein. This has been a stimulating discussion. I think it might be part one of what could be an ongoing conversation as things continue to move on the Hill. I also want to thank our audience for dialing in, and a reminder for them and an invitation for them to join us for our next Teleform conference call tomorrow at 1 p.m. when we'll be discussing the Mount Holly case. But until then, we're adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you, Dean.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.